Wow, you guys ready to worship now after all of that? Anybody else get an aerobic workout? I'm sweating. Yeah, I'm sweating. Man, whew, I'm ready to roll now. All right, well, thank you guys for helping our kids. Can we thank them one more time? And thank all of our volunteers and leaders who made it possible. Just one more time. Yeah. It's really cool because, man, so for our Kids Week, our volunteers really showed up this year. So as a church, we really helped out because 2 weeks before Kids Week ever happened, all of the volunteer slots were filled. We didn't have one volunteer slot that went unfilled. We had so many people here pouring into the kids all week, and it was really, really fun. Obviously, they had a great time, and of course, they learned about Jesus in a very creative way, and that's the whole point. Like she said, it's not daycare, it's discipleship, and we want to help you as families disciple your children so that they'll follow Jesus for the rest of their life, and they'll realize that a life lived for Jesus is the only life worth living, right? So, man, I'm excited about that. Glad for Kids Week. But also, speaking of kids, does anybody ever remember being afraid of the dark? As a kid, you remember, you know, you'd flick the lights out and everything in the room, just the shadows grow long and things get a little scary. You might look under your bed or think there's something under your bed or something lurking outside of your door in the hallway or something living in your closet or that pile of clothes that's over in the corner suddenly becomes this monstrous thing. You could swear you saw it move, right? But then what happens when you flick the light on? Immediately, your perspective changes because as soon as the light comes on, you can actually see everything for what it really is. And that's exactly what we're going to see in this episode of Exodus 3 today as we get into it. So we're going to be there in Exodus 3. You can turn there in your Bible or find it on your Bible app. We'll have it on the screens for you. But there's also a Bible in the pew back in front of you if you want to use that today as well. But man, I'm really looking forward to getting into this story because Moses has his perspective changed. Suddenly the lights get turned on for him, so to speak. He encounters God in a very real way. Remember, in the story so far, Exodus 1 and 2, we haven't really heard God mentioned at all, except for tangentially. He's mentioned once when it says that the midwives feared God. That's the only time we've heard God mentioned. But God shows up here, and Moses has a real encounter with him. Think about Moses for a minute in his story that we've seen so far. For 40 years, he's tried to, you know, do things his own way. At 40 years old, he tried to rescue Israel on his own and fulfill God's plan his way. He killed an Egyptian and ended up having to flee from Egypt out into the wilderness. And now he's been in the wilderness. So he's 80 years old. He's been in the wilderness for 40 years. And here in just a little bit, we're going to talk in a few weeks about how he's going to walk back into Egypt and declare to the ruler of the known world to let God's people go. Now, what's going to happen in the meantime that's going to get Moses from fleeing into the wilderness to walking out of the wilderness with power and courage? Was it because Moses suddenly became brave or discovered a hidden confidence within himself, started believing in himself perhaps, speaking positive things instead of negative things? No, it was none of that. Moses encountered God. That's what happens. And it changes everything for him. And that's actually going to be our main point for today if you'd like to take notes. Encountering God changes everything. It really does. That's really what this chapter is all about, which is what Christianity is all about. If you think about it, it's about what hope happens when broken people encounter the living God. See, most people think Christianity is just about being religious or you've got to be a better person, try harder, do more, you got to focus on the right things. And there's some of that that's in Christianity, but Christianity at its base doesn't begin with self-improvement. It begins with an encounter. As a matter of fact, the defining mark of a genuine Christian isn't simply that you know information about God or even believe in God. Even the demons believe, the Bible says. It's that you've encountered God personally and entered into a relationship with him through what Jesus has done for you. So I just want to ask you, before we get into the text, have you had a personal encounter with God? Have you really had a personal, or do you just know things about God? You might have grown up in church all your life. Do you know things about him or do you know him? And you might not even understand what that question means just yet. You might be like, I don't know what any of this means. That's okay. I'm glad you're here if that's you. Moses' story might help you understand a little bit further, might give you an answer to whether or not you have had an encounter with him. Because when he encountered God, it moved his life in a completely different direction than he thought. And it can do that for you too today. So let's read starting in chapter 3. We're going to read a lot of text today. We're going to start in verse 1. We're going to see what happens when Moses encountered God personally. This is what it says. One day, Moses was tending the flock of his father-in-law, Jethro, the priest of Midian. Now, just FYI, we're not sure why it changed from Reuel to Jethro here. Last week, we read that his name was Reuel, which means a friend of God. This week, it says Jethro, and it introduces him as the priest of Midian. Jethro is thought to maybe be a title, perhaps, because it means excellent. So maybe he's His Excellency, the priest of Midian. We're not exactly sure, but it does say that he's a friend of God. That's what Reuel means. So it's interesting that he's potentially a God-fearer that Moses just happens to meet in the wilderness, right? So there's interesting facts around it, but I just thought I'd say that since if you were here last week. But Moses was tending the flock. He led the flock far into the wilderness and came to Sinai, the mountain of God. It's a very important place, right? Some translations say Horeb. It's the same mountain, Mount Sinai. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire from the middle of a bush. Moses stared in amazement. Though the bush was engulfed in flames, it didn't burn up. "This is amazing," Moses said to himself. "Why isn't that bush burning up? I must go and see it." And when the Lord saw Moses coming to take a closer look, God called to him from the middle of the bush, "Moses, Moses." "Here I am," Moses replied. "Do not come any closer," the Lord warned. "Take off your sandals, for you're standing on holy ground. I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." When Moses heard this, he covered his face because he was afraid to look at God. Now, before we read the rest of the story, let's just notice some stuff here in this scene. It starts off pretty mundane, if you think about it. Moses wasn't expecting anything special to happen this day. It was just another day at work for him. He was off tending the flocks, taking them out into the wilderness. And let's remember how he's probably feeling at this point. 40 years ago, he fled into the wilderness because he thought he was a somebody, and he made a bad decision. It turned out that he felt like a nobody as a result. So at 80 years old, he's just kind of doing his thing. And here's what I love about this. Moses wasn't looking for God in this instance. He wasn't praying. He wasn't fasting. He wasn't even seeking God out here. He was just working, minding his own business. But while he wasn't looking for God, God was looking for him. God took the initiative, and that's the first thing that I want to talk about real quick is the God of the Bible works this way for every single one of us. God always takes the first step. He's always the one who initiates the relationship, always. God found Moses before Moses found God. That's how God works for all of us. Maybe you're here today and you wouldn't even call yourself a Christian. Maybe somebody invited you here, or you're here because of Kids Week, or maybe you're here because a spouse wanted you to come, or because you're asking questions that you don't have answers to and you're not sure what you believe. Man, that's okay. But let me suggest something to you if that's your story. What if you're not here by accident? What if you were meant to be here today? What if all the circumstances in your life brought you into this room today for one moment so that you could encounter God? What if God's been pursuing you long before you ever started to pay attention to or know about Him? Because that's the pattern that we see in the Bible. God pursues people before they ever pursue Him. And ultimately, He does this through Jesus, which is the central Christian message that we believe. See, the central Christian message isn't primarily about us searching for God. The Christian message is primarily about God searching for us. That's the whole point. So maybe the most important question that you ask today isn't, should I be looking for God? Maybe the question you need to wrestle with today is, what if God's already been looking for me? I need to pay attention. Moses thought that he was tending sheep on an ordinary day at work, and he had no idea that God was coming after him, about to interrupt his life forever. But notice something important too here. Moses does have to respond. So I don't want to go too far in one direction, right? God shows up in the burning bush and takes the initiative. Yes, God is the one that gets his attention, but Moses still has to notice. He still has to stop what he's doing and turn aside from where he was going and move in closer. He has to respond. In fact, verse 3 says it, I must go and see. And then verse 4 says, when the Lord saw him coming to take a closer look, that's when God spoke. He didn't call out to Moses. He waited until Moses saw. Moses was moving close, and then God spoke to him. It's not that Moses is earning anything from God here. God already initiated it. But Moses does have to respond, and that's how it works for us too, because that's how relationships work. See, God wants a relationship, not religious performance. And all relationships work this way. It's not some ritual with God. It's not that we have to follow all the rules and do everything He said so that we can approach God. He wants a relationship. A response is necessary in any relationship. You think about it. If somebody takes the initiative in a relationship, it has to be reciprocal, does it not? or else you don't have a relationship. If I say hi to you for the very first time and I want to engage in a relationship with you, what do you have to do in order for us to have a relationship? You have to say hi back, and we have to talk. We have to go back and forth. It has to be a hello, and my name is, and we have to go back and forth. It's reciprocal response, right? It's interesting. I know that for some of you, it may feel like God is absent. We talked about that last week, so I won't belabor that, but I want to assure you, the Bible says that he's not absent. God is always working behind the scenes, even when it feels like he's not, even as we sung today in some of our songs. So I do want to tell you, listen, God has been trying to get your attention. I'm speaking on behalf of God because that's what the Bible tells us. The Bible tells us he's trying to get your attention. Maybe through a difficult season in your life. Maybe you've gone through something hard. Maybe through disappointments. Maybe something like a question that you can't shake or a relationship that you have with somebody. The very fact that you're here today, God is pursuing you. You need to see that. And at some point, you have to decide whether or not you're going to see it and pay attention. I mean, you can ignore it, or you could explain it away and act like God's not pursuing you, or you can do what Moses did. You can stop, you can turn aside from where you are going, and then you can approach God because he's already been approaching you. You can see that he's moving to draw close to you. It requires a response, but when Moses responds, it gets a little scary for him too. Notice that he covers his face and he's afraid. It says he has to take his sandals off to approach God. This is a telling of God's own character. So simultaneously, we have a God who invites us near, yet remains completely holy. That's what we're seeing here about the nature of God. Think about the symbol of the fire itself, right? It's an attractive, beautiful thing. It's warm, it's inviting, even life-giving in certain instances for heat and cooking and all of that. But can you touch fire? No, it'll burn you, right? You can get close, but not too close. If you get too close, it can take your life. It can consume you. So it's both life-giving and it's life-taking. It's both beautiful and terrible at the same time. Man, what an absolutely incredible analogy for God. This is why it's so brilliant that he shows up in this way to Moses. It's a literal demonstration of his characteristic attributes. And he has to take his sandals off here because it requires him to come to God with vulnerability, totally exposed. He can't hide nothing from God. And so to walk on holy ground, he takes his sandals off so there's no barrier between him and God's holiness. That's what sandals often represent. And so he takes his sandals off. He's totally exposed and he was afraid. This tension is very important for us to keep in mind as we move forward in the story. The intimacy and the holiness. The personal nature of God and the power of God. Because God is now revealing himself to Moses in a very specific way. Let's keep reading. And I'm going to read this at length, but just stick with me. It's very interesting. Verse 7. Then the Lord told him, I have certainly seen the oppression of my people in Egypt. I've heard their cries of distress because of their harsh slave drivers. Yes, I'm aware of their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the power of the Egyptians and lead them out of Egypt into their own fertile and spacious land. It's a land flowing with milk and honey, the land where the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites now live. See, we have this huge covenant promise language here going all the way back to Abraham about getting this land that God had promised them. In verse 9, look, the cry of the people of Israel has reached me, and I've seen how harshly the Egyptians abused them. Now go, for I'm sending you to Pharaoh. You must lead my people, Israel, out of Egypt. And maybe we think, wow, okay, it's about to happen. Moses is ready to go now. All the stuff that he was hoping for back 40 years ago, he's like, okay, this is it, let's go. And then verse 11, but Moses protested to God. Who am I to appear before Pharaoh? Who am I to lead the people of Israel out of Egypt? See, in some ways, Moses has changed for the better, I think, because he's got some humility about him, right? He's humble. He's like, man, who am I? But God's answer is, verse 12, God answered, I will be with you. And this is your sign that I am the one who has sent you. When you've brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God at this very mountain. But Moses protested again. If I go to the people of Israel and tell them, the God of your ancestors has sent me to you, they will ask me, what is his name? Then what should I tell them? And God replied to Moses, I am who I am. Say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel, Yahweh, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my eternal name, my name to remember for all generations. Now, we'll get to Moses' insecurities more next week as we get into Father's Day next week. You might want to invite somebody if they're insecure about their faith or insecure in themselves, because we're going to talk about that. But right now, let's focus on how God is revealing himself to Moses, because it's pretty spectacular if you think about the nature of this God. Notice that Moses asks God a very reasonable question. Who are you? Who should I tell people that you are? Because in the ancient world, every nation had gods, right? Egypt had gods. Canaan had gods. Midian, where he's at, had gods. So Moses is essentially asking, which one of you is sending me? Who should I tell the people? Which God are you? And God's answer is both personal and powerful. As we've said, he doesn't say, I'm the God of thunder. He doesn't say, I'm the God of fertility. He doesn't even say, I'm the God who created it all. He simply says, I am who I am. Tell him that I am has sent you. God is I am who I am. It's what Yahweh means in Hebrew. You know, we hear the word Yahweh a lot. It's said to almost sound like we're taking a breath, breathing in and breathing out, because God is simply existence himself. That's essentially what he's saying, because different translations will say different things. Some will say, I will be what I will be. Others will say, I am the one who is. God is really saying, there's just no other being like me. I am being itself. I am the very seat of existence. I am. You think about it, the existence of your parents is what caused you to exist. You came from somewhere, right? You had a cause, your parents. You know, I don't want to give you the birds and the bees talk right now, so you guys all know what that means, but you know, you came from somewhere, okay? And they came from somewhere, and so on and so forth, all the way back to what we believe is Adam and Eve. Because every effect requires a cause, does it not? Every created thing requires a creator. But eventually you have to arrive at some point, something that simply is. Something that is the uncaused cause or the unmoved movement. That's how the philosophers would talk about it, right? The uncaused cause. The thing at the very beginning of the entire domino process of life itself. The Bible simply calls him the I am. He exists. He is. Here's how you could say it. Everything depends on God, but God depends on nothing. He's the one that just simply is. He's not contingent. We are. Suddenly the burning bush starts making more sense here, because if you think about the fire that didn't consume, you know, every fire needs something to consume. It needs fuel. It's contingent on the fuel itself, whether it's gas or wood or something like that. Fire requires something, but not this fire. It's not contingent on anything. It's burning without consuming. The imagery is palpable here. It's trying to teach us something. It was self-sustaining because the God who's in it is self-sustaining. Everything in creation is contingent, but not God. Everything depends on him. He depends on nothing. That's the nature of this God who is, who made us. You need food and water and sleep and exercise and oxygen, and you even need relationships and emotional support. You need all of that. Every one of us is dependent on something every second of every day, but God never gets tired. He never has to sleep or rest. He never gets hungry. He never gets lonely. He never runs out of anything. He never needs advice. He never needs to learn anything new. He never needs to improve. God never changes. God's not like us at all. He's wholly other. And this nature is actually what poses a problem for us as humans. If you think about this more deeply, because if we're honest, we really don't like a God like that, do we? Moses had to cover his face. He's afraid. It's terrifying. Why is it so terrifying? Because we want a manageable God. We don't like a God that we can't control. One who's not contingent on us. A God that we can explain and negotiate with. That's what we want. A God who supports our plans, a God who shares our values, who sees things the way that we see things. He never tells us no. He never gives us directions. We give him directions and he says, yes, okay, whatever you want. That's what we want. The problem is we want God on our terms. That's the issue that we're facing here as humans. But that kind of God, man, just think about it deeply for a second. A God you can control? It's not much of a God at all, is he? If your God can never say no to you, or tell you something that's hard that you don't want to hear, that's no God at all. You're the God in the relationship because you're the one who dictates everything. The very nature of a God is that you worship him. He's the one that tells you what to do, not the other way around. And what's ironic is we don't apply that line of thinking to any relationship that we have in humanity, which is so funny to me because we'll apply it to the greatest being in the universe, the one who is supposed to be our authority, but to other humans, we don't. We accept them on their terms. I mean, if we don't, then it's probably an abusive relationship, right? If I tell my spouse, hey, you have to do everything that I tell you to do, and you can only live the way that I want you to live, we'd have a problem, wouldn't we, okay? If you know Tamara, we'd really have a problem, all right? We don't do that in any case with any other relationship, so why in the world would we do it with God? But that's exactly what we try to do. That's exactly what we do. We choose the parts of God we like, and we ignore the parts that we don't. When it comes to God, we think we get to define him and approach him on our terms. That very problem should show us something about our heart, shouldn't it? We want to be our own God. That's really at the base of this. So we'll try to avoid this kind of God at all costs, because if he really is the creator, then we know he gets to tell us what to do and how to live. We just don't like that. Now, this might be you. If you say things like, well, my God would never, my God would never do this or that, my God would never kill these people or do this thing or allow that tent to fall and kill people, my God wouldn't do these things. Listen, we don't get to dictate to God what he does and doesn't do. If we really believe that he's God and he's sovereign, he's sovereign over it all, and we talked about that a few weeks ago, even when it comes to suffering, even when it feels like he's absent. If you don't like God's design for sexuality, if you don't like God's design for the value of human life, if you don't like God's design for any kind of morality at all, or forgiveness even, if you don't like God's design, what does that say about what you want, really, at base level in your heart? Notice what God tells Moses. He says, take off your sandals. Why? Because Moses doesn't get to approach God on Moses' terms. He has to approach God on God's terms. That's what holiness is. God's not merely bigger than us. He's not merely the creator. He's fundamentally different. He's the creator of all things, and he's our authority and our king. He reigns and rules over it all, as we've sung this morning together. He's the I am, and we're the I not. I'm not, right? But here's what makes the God of the Bible so unique. God's not only powerful, he's personal. This is what makes verse 8 so shocking. After telling Moses who he is, God says, I've seen the oppression of my people. Their cries have come up to me. I've heard their cries. I know their suffering. And I've come down to rescue them. Absolutely astounding. If this really is the God that holds all of creation in his hand, if he's the one that holds all 100 billion galaxies that are out there in our known universe together, and he comes into the creation that he made for us, and he says, I've seen and I've heard and I know. Absolutely astounding. The God who needs nothing chooses to involve himself in people who need everything. The God who completely is self-sufficient chooses to care about slaves who are totally insufficient. God is simultaneously bigger than you think that he is and closer than you think that he is at the very same time. And that's what separates Christianity from every other religion. Because the story of the Bible is not about humanity climbing up to God. It's about God coming down to us in a very personal and powerful way. Because he came down to Moses at the burning bush, but ultimately and finally, and this is the gospel point we need to hear, God came down to rescue us in Jesus. That's what we believe. Jesus is the ultimate Exodus 3 moment. In the burning bush, God revealed himself through fire, sure, but man, that was only a shadow of how God planned to completely and totally reveal himself to the world. Because in Jesus, God revealed himself in the flesh perfectly. Colossians says he's the perfect image of the invisible God. In the burning bush, Moses was told to keep his distance, but in Jesus, sinners are invited to come near, intimately near to him. In the burning bush, Moses hid his face. But in Jesus, we get to behold the glory of God in the face of Jesus himself. The God who said, I am, eventually stepped down into human history and said, I am your bread of life. I am your light in the world. I am the resurrection and the life. And ultimately, maybe the most shocking, he said in John 8, before Abraham was, I am. Now, what was he saying there? Was he just claiming to know God? No. He was claiming to be this God that Moses encountered in the bush. Why? Well, we know that because the Jewish leaders picked up stones to throw at him. They knew that he was equating himself with God, and they thought it was blasphemy if he wasn't. Jesus was saying, I am this God I am the God who is. I am the God who was powerful enough to deliver Israel. And I am the God who's powerful enough to deliver you from whatever it is that you're facing in your life, ultimately from your sin. That heart posture that we have that we don't want, I'm more powerful than even that, he's saying. That posture that you have that you don't want God to be a part of your life, that you want to dictate the terms of your salvation and your life, I can deliver you even from that. Because he lived the human life that you and I should live but don't. And then he died the death that we deserve in our place as a sacrifice for our sin. That mentality that we have, that heart that we have deserves death because it's treason against the God of the universe. This I am God. It's treason against him. We deserve that death, and yet Jesus offers to take it for us. Jesus in my place. And then it doesn't stop there because he rose from the dead and conquered death to say, you can come with me into eternity one day if you put your trust in me. He does something that we can't do ourselves. He makes us holy so that we can approach a holy God. We can come near to God on God's terms, and God's terms is that we simply put our faith in Jesus and receive the gift of salvation that he's offering to us. You think that you have to earn your way to God, but you don't. You don't. You can't. Jesus earned it for you. We can't be good enough. Jesus was good enough. And this is how God has revealed himself to us personally, through this Jesus that came 2,000 years ago into human history, time and space. Now, maybe you're still thinking, I don't know. This Jesus was just a guy that lived, a good teacher, maybe a prophet even, 2,000 years ago. It's not like we've met him personally. I just don't know if I can believe in any of this. It's still a little hard to believe, a little far-fetched for me. Maybe you look at the story of Exodus and you go, but if I had a burning bush like that, that I could see a miracle. If I could see God doing that, I mean, Moses had a burning bush and an angel speaking to him. The bush wasn't being consumed. If I had that, then I would believe. I don't know, Moses protested. You really think that you would believe? If you didn't have more of a revelation to you than what God has given us in Jesus? Because see, the Bible just gives us a record of what Jesus did in his life. The Bible is all about Jesus. So what we have to do is ask the question, what do we do with him? Honestly, I understand where you're coming from if you're struggling with it. But if we're not careful, we can read Exodus 3 and think that every encounter with God has to be this supernatural, super emotional, super strange type of interaction with God. And while that can happen, God can do that, and maybe you'll have that at some point, that's not actually the point of the story at all, because we're not supposed to see the bush here. We're supposed to see Jesus. That's the point. What do you do with him? What do you do with God? God has revealed himself through the bush. That's the whole point. But God has ultimately revealed himself through Jesus. That's what we have to wrestle with. That's why Jesus is so important to our faith. It's so central. The question isn't whether or not you've seen a burning bush. The question is, what will you do with Jesus? That's the question here. We have to really wrestle with that, and it's worth wrestling with because people have been talking about this for 2,000 years, and it's been radically changing people's lives for 2,000 years. That's the fruit of an encounter with God. It's not perfection. I may never be perfect. Man, I love Jesus, and he's working in my life, but I may never be perfect in this life. So the point is not perfection. The point is an encounter with God. That's the real fruit of encountering him, is believing what Jesus did for you and trusting him. That's the fruit. That's it. Believe. That's why I asked you in the beginning of the sermon, have you had an encounter with God? And if you said anything other than I've believed that Jesus did everything necessary to save me, then you haven't, friend. You haven't. And I want to share that with you today. It's not, have you attended church? Not, were you raised religious? Not, do you believe God exists? But have you responded to what Jesus has done for you? Have you believed in him? Because the biggest obstacle for some of you isn't that God seems absent. It's that you've spent years explaining away why he has revealed himself to you in certain ways that you're not okay with. You've explained away the fact that he's been pursuing you because you don't like it on those terms. You want it on yours. That's the issue. And you say, well, why belief? Why do we have to believe? What's the big deal about belief? It's a relationship. You have to respond. God doesn't force you. That's the beauty of the gospel, and that's what makes Christianity unlike anything else. We don't have to conquer countries. We don't have to beat people over the head and win them over and make them follow our morality. And make them follow. That's not what God does. God invites Moses in, even in this display of ultimate power. And in the display of ultimate power of him raising Jesus from the dead, he invites you in and says, will you believe? Will you trust? I want you to see, if you're here today, it's because the God who pursued Moses is pursuing you. I want you to believe that and see that. And just like Moses, there comes a moment when you have to decide what you'll do when God gets your attention. Will you ignore him? Will you explain him away? Or will you respond? Because listen, an encounter with God changes everything. And I want you to hear from somebody in our church whose life was changed when he responded to God and he encountered God for the first time. And I'll just say it's really just kind of a mundane story. And I don't mean that prerogative, like in a bad way. I don't mean that, you know, in a way that makes it seem like it's less than. It's not. It's very similar to what Moses went through. Just another day. But then God shows up. So I want to share this story with you. It's David's story. Let's watch this together and then I'll talk through how to respond.
My name is David. You know, I actually grew up in the faith. Really loved God, loved Jesus. But I started to step away from the faith. Wanted to do things my way. Wanted to do things how I thought they should be done. And I also started to kind of see some of the messiness that you get when you deal with people in the church. And I kind of placed that on God. And then I think what ultimately made me walk away from the faith is I started dealing with mental health issues. I was diagnosed with schizophrenia, which eventually became schizoaffective disorder. And so that kind of made me step away from the faith entirely, thinking, oh, God is maybe just a delusion in people's heads. So, you know, in hindsight, I really did see that God was pulling me back to him the whole time. And the thing that really brought me back finally was my sister sent me a message with a Christian song. She was not the person I expected something Christian to come from. So I really just listened to the song, and it was about sort of coming back to Christ. And slowly I started watching sermons online. My mom contacted Carter, and Carter wrote her back and invited me to come to the church. So eventually, after that, I decided I'm going to get baptized there. I've just been here at Redemption ever since. I mean, when I first started coming to Redemption, I showed up pretty rarely. I think like maybe once a month. And there's just a lot of things in this church that sort of gets you on the pathway to sort of like following the Christian life, I guess. And so I decided that that's when I was going to try to very consciously start showing up more often. I mean, just to be very frank about it, like you get what you put in, right? And when I wasn't really putting a lot of time and effort into showing up to church every Sunday and going to the groups and like consciously talking to people when I come to church, I really tried to do like the solo Christian thing. And that's something Carter says. It's like, there's no solo Christians. And so I fought against that, but I do realize that it's true, right? Because God works through multiple people, not just one Christian. I mean, the very real thing is that because I was atheist, I thought this stuff didn't exist. I thought like the supernatural couldn't happen and stuff like that. So it really is like, it's like I'm rediscovering Jesus. There's a lot of people that talk about like timelines, and there's a joke about like, this is the worst timeline. And for me, I realize like, it's really the best timeline. We have this God that is willing to come to earth for us and die for us, right? The fact that I was like actively hostile towards God, towards Jesus, and he still decided to bring me back into the family after I, you know, said terrible things about him and you know, made fun of Christians that believed in him, right? And he's using me in ways that I never planned. The idea that he can take me and use me for something better than what I already had planned for myself is just incredible, considering I was an enemy of his. I mean, I think the one thing that you would have to ask yourself is, do you actually want to know him? Do you actually want to know Jesus? Because I think if you realize that you still want to be in control of your life and you want to do what you want and all that stuff, then the Christian life is going to be a really hard life for you. But I will also say, how's that working out for you? Is it going great? Is it going to stay great? Do you think it'll always be great? I think the main thing is that you have to just decide at some point that you're going to give it a full college try and test it and see. Because if you never really fully commit, you can't know the full rewards.
Man, isn't David's story powerful? But it's exceedingly personal. I mean, how, like I said, it's kind of normal. Like, that's what happens when somebody encounters God for the very first time. That's what it looks like when they realize God's been pursuing them. They haven't had to do anything to pursue God. All he has to do is respond. And listen, Moses responded. David responded. The question that I have for you today is, will you respond? Is that where you're at today? I hope that you will. Because maybe you've been asking some of the wrong questions. Maybe you've been asking, like, man, am I good enough? Do I know the right things enough? Have I been, you know, doing and being and, man, you need to just stop. Stop and turn aside from that way, just like Moses did, and look at God and respond to him. Respond to Jesus. Because the real question is not just will you respond, but what will you do with Jesus in your life? Jesus is here for us to introduce us to God, and he can do that for you too today. You need to start asking the right question. Will you respond? So that may be you. And for some of you, it might be an appropriate response for you to put your trust and faith in Jesus for the very first time today. Stop trying to save yourself and finally surrender to the one who came to save you. God is pursuing you right now. And I just want to tell you, listen, I don't mean to sound ominous, but that doesn't mean God will always be pursuing you. I don't know. The Bible does seem to indicate that there are times when God gives us up to our desires. I just want to encourage you and give you a warning. If God's pursuing you and you finally realize that, today's the day. Put your faith in him. Trust him. What's stopping you? I know you might have questions, and I know not everything's answered. You might be going through something hard. You might have things that you don't understand. I get it. But if you realize that this is about a relationship, not about what you know and don't know, not about the religion you follow, it's about knowing God and him knowing you. And if you can start there, then you can believe in him. And so for the others of you today, maybe for you, your next step is baptism, because you have put your faith in Jesus over the last couple of weeks or the last couple of months or maybe in the last couple of years, but you've never made that faith public. That's what baptism is in the Bible. Jesus gave us baptism as an important symbol to show that we now follow him and we believe everything that he's done for us. It's not that it saves you. Baptism doesn't save you, and yet it demonstrates the salvation you believe that you have in Christ. Very important. It's kind of like a wedding. And I don't know when I fell in love with Tamara, and I don't know when she fell in love with me, but we fell in love, and then we have a moment in time where we made vows to each other, we committed to each other, and we look back on that moment as the most special moment of our lives, of our marriage, of our relationship. That's what baptism is for the believer. Baptism gives you that moment where you say, I'm committing to follow Jesus, I know he's committed to me, and I'm going to live my life for him for the rest of my life. So if you need to take that next step in your discipleship journey with him, then you need to fill out the card that we have in the pew in front of you there. It says baptism on the top. Fill that out and give it to one of our prayer counselors today before you leave. They want to talk to you about taking that next step. And we want to help you through that because that's a very important part of following Jesus. If you can't put your faith in him publicly, then you probably can't follow him. So we need to do that together. But then for the rest of us, those who have been baptized, who follow Jesus, maybe you need to respond to God in a fresh way today. I don't know, maybe you remember you've encountered this God before, but you've forgotten, and you started to resent some things in your life, and you're like, yeah, I really would rather have a God on my terms, even though I begrudgingly know that he exists. Man, turn that upside down and go, you don't have to be begrudging. God is with you. The God who created the universe also holds every molecule and cell and quark in your body together. He knows you more intimately than you do. And so as a believer today, you might need to spend some time praying and asking God to give you a fresh encounter with him, to remind you of what it looks like to know him and to be known by him. Don't leave out of here today just going, let's just go about our day. That is not what happened to Moses when he encountered the burning bush. Man, let's take a moment. Let's spend some time in prayer. You might want to come up front. We call this our symbolic altar. It's just the front of our stage. But there's something important about you taking steps in your faith. It's just a symbol to God to say, I'm going to come near to you. I know you've drawn near to me, so now I'm going to draw near to you. You might need to come up and pray and ask God to do that in your life. We're also going to take communion together, which is a symbol for those of us who continue to commit our lives to Jesus. Like baptism is that first symbol, communion is the ongoing symbol. So if you're a believer in the room, we would encourage you to take this with us. If you want to continue to commit to follow Jesus, come up and get your elements and hold them at your seat. I'm going to lead us in taking communion together. But over the next few minutes, let's just take time to respond. Let's pray and ask God, and then I'll close us out in prayer in just a few moments and lead us in taking communion. So let's respond together now. Thanks so much for listening with us today. We hope that it was an encouragement to you. But you know, we don't see this as a replacement for gathering with other believers in a local church context. So if you don't have a local church, we would encourage you to plug in with one wherever you are. And if you're in Roanoke, Virginia, we'd love to invite you to plug in with us here at Redemption Church. And you're welcome anytime to gather with us. But you can check us out online at our website, redemptionroanoke.com. You can look for other content or resources there. But thanks again for listening.